Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your 2010 tax returns today with Steve Schmidt. Steve, a CPA, MST, and Managing Director at the Madison Office of RSM McGladrey. 25 years with McGladrey and in the business, so he's had a lot of experience in. And we meant to have another fellow on today, and he was ill at the last minute, and Steve said, I'll fill in. So here he is with us by phone. Steve, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Well, wait a minute. There
we go. More than 25 years. This is the 25th year on your show.
Oh, 25 years on our show?
On your show, yes. So.
Oh, my goodness. We grew up together.
Just about.
Got older together. Wow. Well, you've done such a great job over there. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's always my pleasure to be on your program.
Well, I tell you what, already a lot of callers online, but just sort of in way of review, anything sort of different in the 2010 this year as opposed to maybe 2009?
Well, a couple things. First and foremost, this isn't a 2010 issue. It was really a late legislation in December where the Bush tax cuts got extended for another 2 years. So that'll really impact us more in 2011 and 2012.
Okay.
But so that's really pretty significant for many of our listeners. On the 2010, some things that have expired that you won't get on the 2010 return that were available on the 2009 return is you could get an increased standard deduction if you didn't itemize your deductions for real estate taxes and sales tax, on autos. That is gone. For those that have been unemployed on 2009, there was a $2,400 exclusion of unemployment compensation on the federal return. That is gone. Wisconsin still has a limited exclusion if you have lower income. That hasn't changed. So those are some things that went away. Another big issue is alternative minimum tax. For 2010, we were scheduled to have lower alternative minimum tax exemptions with the tax bill that came into being in December. The alternative minimum tax exemptions were actually increased from last year.
Mm-hmm.
So for many middle-income taxpayers making, you know, $100,000 to $600,000 of income, or probably on a joint return, it's probably more than $150,000.
Mm-hmm.
The higher income, they will have less exposure to the alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. One other thing that's new this year, although April 15th comes on Friday, because of a federal D.C. Holiday, the tax returns for 2010 aren't due until Monday, April 18th. So there's several extra days for the procrastinators.
Okay. Oh, I'm not one of those. I like to have mine done and in.
Well, particularly if you have refunds.
Yeah. If there's little money coming back, I want it right now.
One other thing I might mention for 2010, although you would have dealt with this by now if it was relevant to you, is Roth IRA conversions. Prior to 2010, you could not convert if your adjusted gross income was greater than $100,000. Starting with 2010, anybody can convert Roth IRA or IRA balances to Roth IRAs. And if you convert in 2010, you can split the taxable income alternatively between 2011 and 2012.
Oh.
Or if you wish to, you can elect to report all of the income on the 2010 tax return. So you have some options if you did a conversion to a Roth IRA in 2010.
So those are some things to think about, and we already have a number of people to visit with you online waiting. So let's go to the phones and to Gordon in Medford, who has a question for you. Hi, Gordon. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I've got a question about taxable income. I did convert in 2010 to a Roth, and I understand that like $34,000 is the tax break for a single. How concerned should I be about that $34,000? Is everything over that taxed at 25% or just the amount over that $34,000?
Well, you have a graduated rate bracket, and from zero to about $8,400, your rate is 10%. From $8,400 to $34,000, it's 15%. And then you're in a 25% rate bracket from the $34,000 income level to about $82,000. So it's just we have, you know, the higher the income, taxable income, yeah, the higher the rate. And the rates go as high as 35% once you hit, you know, $374,000 in taxable income.
Okay.
Okay, that'll help me determine whether I, what I do with that Roth and whether I pay everything.
Right. And then if it pushes you in a higher bracket, and then you can manage your income for 2011 and 2012, so you can keep it in the lower brackets. Since the Bush tax cuts were extended, that gives you some flexibility. So you just need to take a look at your personal situation to see in which year or years your marginal bracket will be the lowest.
All right. Makes good sense. Thanks, Gordon, for calling. Michael in Oak Creek, we are on to you. Thanks for calling, Michael.
Yes. Hi, Larry. Steve, I would like to know if you can deduct legal fees and fines, and I do itemize.
Okay, fines are specifically not deductible, and then legal fees, you got to take a look at the origin of the claim, and you characterize the legal fees accordingly. So if the legal fees are for a personal matter, likely non-deductible. If they're for a business matter, they'd be deductible as a business expense. If it's for, you're an employee and you're negotiating an employment contract or you have some dispute with the employer.
Oh, no, they're personal.
Yeah, if they're personal, then they're not deductible.
Oh, it's funny because medical expenses are.
Well, you have, there's a number of tax expenditures when you take a look at Schedule A, medical expenses, income taxes, state income taxes, real estate taxes, home mortgage interest expense, charitable contributions. All those things, relate to, your personal situation. But the tax code has specifically allowed a deduction for those items. But if it's otherwise personal and not specifically allowed, there's a code section. It's actually Section 262 that says personal expenses are not deductible.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Michael. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your questions. If you have a tax question for Steve Schmidt, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Open lines, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Jim in Wanakee next. Jim, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple of questions, but I'll just take one first and maybe ask for a follow-up. My wife and I received Social Security for the first time in 2010. She received it for part of the year. I received it for all of the year. And what I'm wondering is how do you calculate whether you have to pay taxes, federal taxes and state taxes on that Social Security? And I do my own taxes, and
sure,
and we do itemize, and so we're always looking for options for paying
sure
the least amount that we have to
yes
pay.
You're a Wisconsin resident?
Yes.
Wisconsin's easy. Wisconsin no longer taxes Social Security benefits.
Oh, wonderful.
So that makes that easy. Federal, if you get a Form 1040 tax package.
Did I get that?
You can get that at IRS.gov.
Oh, okay.
On pages 25, and starting on, there's a little discussion, and then starting on page 26, there's actually a worksheet that you fill out. It'll walk you right through it. On a joint return, I can just give you a little guidance. If half your Social Security plus tax-exempt income plus your other adjusted gross income is more than $32,000, part of your Social Security is going to be taxable. But, you know, I can't work through the numbers with you over the radio.
Sure. Here,
but if you go get the instructions, look at that worksheet starting on page 26, it'll walk you right through it.
There you go.
Hey, very good. Now, can I have a follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
What about my wife and I are both over 65, and isn't there some kind of a break that that both of us will get on, I mean, as far as like taxes on both federal and state?
Yeah, on Wisconsin, there's an additional $250 personal exemption.
Okay.
For you. And then on federal, if you do not itemize, but you claim the standard deduction, there's an additional standard deduction amount. If you're single, it's $1,400. If you're a married couple, it's $1,100 per spouse that's over 65.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So it's an increased standard deduction.
So both spouses do not have to be over 65.
Well, it's whoever is over 65 on a joint return, they'll get the $1,100. That's correct.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Jim. And Ron in Grand Marais, Michigan. On to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thank you, guys. I have actually two quick questions. I have twin daughters, and they both have some tax issues.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask for one daughter was injured.
How old are the daughters?
How old are their daughters?
They're 27.
Okay.
And they both just got jobs finally, which is good. But one daughter was injured in a bicycle accident and has received some money from an insurance settlement. Is that going to have to be declared as income for its taxing?
Okay. There's an exclusion for amounts for physical, personal injury. So if that's what the recovery from the insurance company is for, likely not taxable. So you got to take a look at why you received it. And, again, it goes kind of the origin of the claim. And then if it's for physical personal injury, that is specifically excluded.
Okay.
Okay. And the other one is my other daughter didn't she declared more exemptions than she was entitled to. And so now she owes state and federal tax, and she has no money to pay it. What can she do, and how much is she? I assume maybe she can set up a payment plan, but are they going to give her very much time to pay that off?
I can't. Is she a Michigan resident?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know what Michigan does, but the IRS has a form that you can file and request an installment payment. They charge you a little fee for that. But you file that, and then they'll come and you say that I'd like to pay so much a month, and then they'll either approve it or not approve it. Oftentimes they will approve it. You know, for example, there's interest you have to pay, which is quite low right now, but then there's also a penalty of 5% per month of failure to pay tax when due. And then I don't know what Michigan is, but Wisconsin on delinquent tax, it's an 18% rate. So it's not a great deal. So you may want to figure out what your costs are. And sometimes if there's a family member that the daughter can borrow from, you might save yourself some non-deductible interest and penalties. But, you know, I don't know what your family situation is.
Yeah.
But,
or even to borrow the money from, if you can borrow the money from a lending institution.
Oh, sure.
You're probably money ahead, quite a bit money ahead if you can do that. There you go, Ron. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Schmidt, our guest today, managing director at RSM McGladrey's office in Madison. 25 years on Wisconsin Public Radio, giving us information about our tax returns. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Steve Schmidt of RSM McGladrey about your 2010 taxes. Steve had an email from Greg who wondered if he asks, is the only advantage of doing a Roth conversion by December 31st that you can space the tax liability over 2 years?
Yes, that's right. We talked about that at the beginning of the show. Is if you convert in 2010, then you can pay tax on half the tax amount in 2011 and half in 2012, or alternatively, you can elect to pay tax all in 2010. Now, in subsequent years, you do not get any two-year split. You have to pay tax on it in the year you convert.
So but you would have had to have it done
by December 31st.
Yeah. Okay. Marie in Bayview, we are on to you now. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I am, not by my own choice, right now retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm collecting Social Security, and my job was eliminated, and
okay.
I'm looking for a new job. And I'm collecting Social Security, and I have been for the whole year, and I received my income tax stuff from Social Security. And, of course, you know, when I was working, my medical stuff was always deducted before taxes were taken out. Now, I do have medical deductions on my 2010 form here. I mean, it lists what I received,
yes,
in direct deposit, what Medicare Part B deductions was, and what Medicare Part D deductions were.
Okay.
And then it's all added together. I'm wondering whether or not I need to pay taxes on my premiums for B&B, and also I have a supplement we'll call C, I guess, a supplemental insurance. And am I going to be able to claim all those as deductions?
Expenses, okay.
Yeah, now you wouldn't pay tax on B&D premiums. You would deduct those. And they are eligible to be treated as medical expenses, along with all your other health insurance premiums and unreimbursed medical expenses. If all those uninsured, your out-of-pocket expenses exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, then you get to deduct the excess in 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So, for example, if you had $20,000 in adjusted gross income, 7.5% of that would be $1,500. So if you had $2,500 in medical expenses, your Schedule A deduction, if you itemize deductions, would be the $2,500 of expenses less the $1,500 threshold for a deduction of your medical expenses of $1,000 on Schedule A.
I understand that, and I do itemize my deductions. But is this these insurance premiums that I paid, is that going into that?
Yes, it is.
The whole thing with the 7.
Yes.
It goes into the $2,500 in my example. So it's part of your medical expenses.
Yep.
Well, you know, I know it's part of my medical expenses.
That goes on Schedule A.
And you can deduct.
How do I deduct those? You just explained to me about the 7.5%.
Yeah, go to Schedule A. And the very first part of Schedule A is medical expenses.
Doing my taxes for eons,
mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I know that. But in Schedule A, I'm not looking at one right now. In Schedule A, I mean, when I was working, I didn't pay taxes on any of the insurance my medical insurance that was covered, you know, by my employer. I didn't pay taxes on that, and the premium that was taken out for my part, I did not pay taxes on that, and it wasn't included in my income.
All right. If your employer pays the health insurance then you cannot include it in your medical expenses. If you pay it, but you do it pre-tax through a cafeteria-type plan, then those premiums also are not deductible because you didn't pay tax on the income out of which those premiums were paid.
And now you have paid taxes on the premiums that you're paying, and so therefore they are can logically fit as a deduction.
Right. If you're making the payments yourself on an after, you know, on an after-tax basis, not a pre-tax basis, then you get to include those on your medical and dental expenses on line one of Schedule A.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Marie. Appreciate it. June in Arborvitae, we'll turn to you next. Hi, June.
Hi, Larry and Steve. My question, I think, is a little simpler than that. All I'm looking for is the instruction sheet for 1040. I mean, it's a book. It's like 50 pages. I rely on that to fill out my taxes, and I can't find it on the Internet. How can I get a copy of the instructions?
All right. If you go to irs.gov.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's there. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I see instructions for 1040.
Do you have to have some kind of special something on your computer that will accept that and show it?
Not that I'm aware of, but I mean, I can't handle your technical computer issues over the radio. But if you go to irs.gov, just go into the search button and put in, you know, Form 1040.
Okay.
And see if it doesn't bring up the form for you.
Yeah. I've got the form, but I need the instructions.
Yes, and when I do that, I get both the Form 1040 and then the line right below it says Form 1040 instructions.
Okay, I'll try that. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. Yeah, I just did it myself. There it is.
You got it? Okay, very good. So it worked for you, Larry.
Yeah, it worked for me too.
Good, okay.
Thanks, Julie. And Bob in Peshtigo will give you a chance now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. My question is kind of twofold. First part, mileage that you can claim. What is the amount per mile, and did it change last year?
You're talking 2010. Yeah, the mileage rate for business purposes was 55 cents per mile in 2009 and 50 cents per mile for 2010. I might just note that.
Did that change during the year at all?
Not during the year. It stayed the same for the whole year.
Okay, and the second part of my question real quick is I get compensated 30-some-odd cents for some of my driving.
Mm-hmm.
Can I still claim the difference between the 50 that the government allows and the 30-some-odd that I get reimbursed?
Yes. Are you an employee?
Yeah.
Yes. So you would do that by completing Form 2106. You would take all your business miles, multiply it by 50%. Then there's a line to subtract reimbursements. And the excess would be treated as an employee business expense, deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction on Schedule A. So you'd need to itemize deductions to benefit from that excess.
Sure.
Right. Can I make it as simple as take the dollar amount, divide it out, and then take that times the difference for an amount to put in there, or do I have to have a mile?
Well, you got to complete the Form 2106. Which there's questions on there about your total miles you drove the car during the year, what your business mileage was, the fact that you maintained records, and then it walks you through what the business mileage was times the rate, and then you'll enter a place for your reimbursement, and it'll get you the net amount that you take forward to line 21 of Schedule A.
There you go. Thanks, Bob. Thank you for calling.
So Form 2106 would be your form.
All right. Ken in Madison. On to you. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I am one of two heirs of an estate, and it's been in dispute. It is going to settle in 2011, and I'm wondering if that will be taxable, that settlement amount that I receive.
Okay, I can't answer it totally authoritatively, but I can give you some general guidelines. Is generally inheritances are tax-free, okay? So if you receive stock in ABC company or a house or whatever, it's generally tax-free. There are some exceptions to that. One is what's called income in respect of a decedent. So if the decedent was a cash method taxpayer and hadn't paid tax on the income before death, but it's taxable, then those amounts received by the heirs are taxable. Example are like IRA accounts, retirement plan accounts, interest that accrued on savings account but wasn't taxable before death. And there's others, but just to give you a few examples. So those items, annuities is another one, will likely be taxable in full or in part. Then just one other item is an estate becomes a taxpayer of itself if the estate earns income during the period of administration and you're a residual beneficiary of the estate. If you take a distribution out of the estate, if there's taxable income in the estate for that year, that income is pulled out of the estate to the people that get distributions. So those are the two reasons why you may pay tax on some or part of your inheritance. But other than that, inheritances are tax-free.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Barbara in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hello. I have some questions about my son who just turned 24. Just calling to confirm that since he turned 24 in November of 2010, I can no longer claim him as a dependent.
Well, is he a full-time student?
He is a full-time student.
Yeah, and they have to be under 24, be claimed as a dependent. That is
correct.
Okay,
and I believe he cannot be claimed as a qualifying resident because he did make more than the income limit last year, about $3,650 or whatever it is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. If you have a person that earns less than the standard or the personal exemption amount, they still might be eligible to be claimed as a dependent. But as you pointed out, he earned more than that, and therefore you would not be eligible. That is correct.
Okay. All right. And my question is, am I allowed to continue to take his education credits, or does he need to claim those himself? And if so, can you still use a 1040 easy form, or do I need to go to the regular 1040 for him then?
In order for you to claim the credits, he has to be a dependent. And I don't know off the top of my head whether the EZ has the education credit on it. I would doubt it. But if you just go get the form, go to the package on IRS.gov, and it'll say who may use this form, and just check that out. But I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. There you go. Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I got an email from Shannon in Green Bay. My 51-year-old husband took a $1,000 distribution from his Roth IRA. We were told if we paid it back in 60 days, there wouldn't be a penalty. Is that true?
Yes, right. If you take distributions from an IRA and roll them back over within 60 days, you do not have to pay tax on the distribution.
All right. Patricia in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. In listening to your show and other tax shows I've listened to, I wonder if people are not confused in regard to converting a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. The people seem to think that they had only until December 31st, 2010 to make that kind of conversion. That really only applied for those who had higher incomes. Other than that, people can do that conversion anytime, and they don't have to do it all at once, but in small pieces, so they kind of spread out those taxes over the years.
I need to correct one thing you said, is those with higher income, even after 2010, can continue to convert. So the only pressure, if I can call it pressure or benefit, of converting by December 31st in 2010 is you were eligible for a two-year spread of the taxable income amount over 2011 and 2012. And 2010 was the first year where those with more than $100,000 of adjusted gross income could convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. But that continues on into the future. It's just the two-year spread
What I was trying to say is that they could spread it out over 5 years, 6 years, whatever.
Well, just by you can always, yeah, if you just take out whatever amount you want and make it a smaller amount, you're
correct.
Right. You're exactly right.
Correct.
You can do that as a way of leveling your income. That's a good point.
That's a good point. All right. Thanks, Patricia.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. If people are not on the internet, in order to get the instructions for the tax forms, and I've actually done this myself, I've gone to the public library, at least in the Madison Public Library, usually has those instructions. I assume most libraries would have them. Steve, correct?
I know they used to. Post offices, banks, libraries all used to stock those. In this day of going paperless and green and all that stuff, I'm not sure whether they all still do or not, but you certainly can call and find out.
Yeah, it would be libraries, banks, and post offices would be at least places to look.
Right, very good point.
All right, let's go to Joe in Madison next. Joe, hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Say, we had a home invasion in 2010, and I was wondering, are auto insurance as well as homeowners insurance were involved, can we claim the deductibles?
Well, yes, that would be a theft loss, and the theft loss is deductible as an itemized deduction. There's a floor of $100, and then plus, now casualty loss, I know there's 10% of adjusted of income as well, and I think that same thing applies to theft losses. And, that is how it would be reported. On Schedule A.
So I'm thinking sort of like the, there's a threshold sort of like with your medical expenses then, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Also, when the insurance companies paid up, they depreciated most of the household items, computers, laptops, and stuff like that. Can we claim the difference between what we paid for them and what they paid us for?
Let's say
No, because it's the lesser of the fair market. It would be for personal use property. Your casualty or theft loss is the lesser of the fair value or your insurance reimbursement at the time of casualty or theft.
Okay.
Now, if it were business asset, you know, then you would take your adjusted basis. That'd be cost less accumulated depreciation minus your insurance proceeds to determine whether there was a gain or loss, and then if it were business property, for casualty losses, there's a provision that you can, if it's a gain, you can elect to defer the gain by reducing the basis of replacement property.
All right, there you go. Thank you for calling. And more callers online here. Look, Phil in Oregon has a question for you. Steve, Phil, hello.
Hello. My question is, I got a Form 1099-R from T. Rowe Price because I converted a regular IRA to a Roth.
Mm-hmm.
On what line on 1040 do I report that?
It's the taxable IRA distribution would be 15, and then also go to Form 8606. If you do the conversion and you want to split the income, you can pay tax in half in 2011 and half in 2012. So go to the Form 8606 as well.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Norm in Lake of the Hills, Illinois. We're on to you now. Hi, Norm. Whoops, we lost Norm. Let's try Robin in Madison next. Robin, hello to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I am pretty young. I'm only 21, so I'm really new to the whole tax thing.
Okay.
And last year, I only had, for the 2009 taxes, I only had one job, so it was really easy. But for the 2010 taxes, I have two jobs, and I'm a full-time student, and I pay for everything on my own. Like, I don't have any grants or anything. Would it be worth my time and money to go to, like, a tax place to help me out, or should I still try to do it on my own?
Oh, I would think all you have is wages, no itemized deductions.
I'm sorry, what?
All you have is wages and no itemized deductions.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty simple form. You hear the ads on radio and TV for free file, or I think the IRS even has a free file website. I think you would get a good result using one of those free file alternatives.
Okay, and then also one of my classmates said that like you can get money back for buying your books. Is that true or not?
Money back for buying your books.
Yeah, like you can...
As a business expense, so to speak.
Well, if you're an undergrad student working on a degree, those are personal expenses and not deductible. Once you've met the minimum requirements for a trade or profession, then you can treat education expenses as a business expense. But being age 21, I would doubt that. You're probably still working on your first degree.
Yeah.
And you haven't met the minimum requirements for whatever you're going to do. So those would be personal expenses. The other thing, tuition, you might want to follow up on two things.
Okay.
There's a tuition deduction, both for federal and Wisconsin. The federal deduction is limited to $4,000. The Wisconsin, if you're going to a Wisconsin institution or a certain limited out-of-state educational institutions, it's up to $6,000. And then on the federal return, there's both the American Opportunities Tax Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. So what you'll want to do is get IRS Form 8863. You're likely eligible for some education tax credits.
Okay.
Even if you have no tax liability, the American Opportunities Tax Credit, 40% of it, so that's up to $1,000, can be refundable.
Okay.
So I think you'll want to take a look at Form 8863 and its instructions, because you're likely going to benefit from education credit. And in Wisconsin, the tuition subtraction of up to $6,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
awesome.
Worth a look.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what those credits do to Free File, because we have our own software here, and I don't even look at those websites, so I don't have the slightest idea what their capabilities are. But, take a look and see if
it might be worth the long. You might need to use the long form, but it would be worth it.
And even if you have to use a long form, if you just read the instructions and follow the forms carefully, I would think in an hour or less, you could accomplish it.
And if you save $300, you've just you got $300 an hour for your time.
Well, and it's likely going to be $1,000 or more on the education credit. So the payback is pretty handsome.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks, Robin. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Schmidt, our guest today from the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our on-air producer today. Thanks to her. And you'll hear her wonderful voice whenever you call in at 1-800-642-1234. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with Steve Schmidt. Steve, we have more callers online and an emailer as well. Sherry in Menominee wonders, how are gambling winnings and losses accounted for on both state and federal income taxes?
Sure. The gambling earnings are included in income on your federal return on line 21 for other income. And then, of course, that carries over to Wisconsin, and it becomes taxable on the Wisconsin return as well. Wisconsin is really simple. They just don't allow a deduction for gambling losses. Or actually, Wisconsin, for itemized deductions, it's not really deductions. It's a credit that you get, but they don't allow a credit for gambling losses. On the federal return, You're entitled to deduct gambling losses to the extent of gambling income on line 28 as a other miscellaneous deduction.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Let's go to Norm in Lake of the Hills, Illinois. Hi, Norm.
Good morning, Larry and Steve. Thank you very much. Steve, got a question for you regarding savings bonds. An uncle of mine came across some bonds that were taken out years ago during World War II by my mother, who passed away years ago. And then up to my sister and I, and we were both about 75 last year. And I heard you say earlier to somebody else about something about inheritance. Inheritances are tax-free. How would I treat this? I normally use the deduction form and everything because I have some deductions like property taxes and so forth, so I detail everything. Now, how would I treat this? About $1,500 amount.
The taxable interest?
Yes, it says interest on U.S. savings bonds and taxes. I cashed them at my local bank.
Yes. Unless your mother was reporting any income on those bonds, which you can make an election to do that, very few people do. I'd be surprised if she did. That interest will be taxable to you and your sibling.
So that wouldn't be considered an inheritance then?
It clearly is an inheritance, but the interest is taxable. Let's say you had $5,000 of bond proceeds, $1,500 was interest, and $3,500 was a return of her principal. The $1,500 of interest is going to be taxable to you. The $3,500 of principal amount would not.
I see. Okay, so I'd be paying taxes on the entire thing. It just says interest here on my bank.
Just the interest.
How would that $1,400 exemption that you talked about earlier for single persons, how would that work? Could I still use that filing a long form?
Well, the $1,400 I talked about was just the additional standard deduction for a single person over age 65. But in your case, are you single or married?
I'm single. I was 75 last year.
Okay. If you're a single taxpayer, you won't pay tax. You got your standard deduction, which is $5,700 plus $1,400 plus your personal exemption of $3,650. Okay, so you won't pay tax unless your total income is more than $10,750. Matter of fact, you don't even need to file a return if your adjusted gross income, not including Social Security, is less than $10,750.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you very much, Norm, for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And Ellen in Kenosha, on to you now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I'm filing a tax return for a family member who died last year. And my first very simple question is, we donated a lot of her belongings. Can we claim those as a deduction?
Sure, but not by the decedent. Okay, the decedent's tax year started January 1st, 2010, and then at the point of death, the decedent's tax year ends, all right? So then that property that he owned would have been inherited by somebody.
Yes.
Whoever inherited that property would have a right for the deduction for the contribution, whoever had a right to that property. But the decedent died, the contribution was not made while he or she was living, therefore there's no contribution on the decedent's return.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Thanks.
And if you get the Form 1040 instructions, there's some special rules that are discussed on page 88 of the 1040 instructions, which you might want to take a look at.
Okay. There you go.
And right. Also, if there's a refund, there's a form that might need to be filed for claiming that refund, which is discussed there as well.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Ellen. And let's go to Angie in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I have a question about I'm the trustee for the estate of my dad's. he left everything to my kids, who are underage. Well, they're not able to get it until they're 24. And I pay for the house and the property taxes and all that. Is there any, who can claim those taxes? Anybody or nobody?
So the house is in, was given to your kids.
Right.
So who owns the house now? Is it in the trust?
It's in an estate.
You said you were a trustee, not executor or personal rep. So.
Right. We're all done with the whole process, and now it's just in the trust.
It's in the trust. So now the house is held by the trust?
Right, and it has my kids' names on the deed and everything.
Sure. So, all right, a trust becomes a taxable entity unto itself, all right?
Mm-hmm.
It has income, and it is entitled to deductions. And it would file a Form 1041, and on the 1041, you would report the income and claim allowable deductions. If there were any distributions out of the trust to the beneficiaries, then the income that otherwise might be taxed to the trust gets pulled out and might be taxed to the beneficiaries if there were distributions. So I would suggest that, if there's any significant size to your trust, you probably should find someone who is capable dealing with the taxation of trusts.
Yeah.
Because I would think you might need a little help with that. That's very, very different. When the trust retains its own income, it pays tax on it. When it makes distributions, the beneficiaries pay tax on it. Certain things are income for fiduciary accounting purpose, like capital gains are taxable income, but they're not fiduciary accounting income. And there's all kinds of different rules that I might suggest you seek professional help.
Okay. We actually were exempt from fiduciary whatever. They did a thing through the courts where we don't have to necessarily file taxes, I guess. So technically...
Then, without knowing exactly what was done or reading your trust instrument, I wouldn't be able to advise you.
No.
So even on that part, even if you don't need a trust return on an ongoing basis, I don't know why you wouldn't. But if you don't... that professional would be able to say, here's what you need to do on an ongoing basis.
You'd want to go back to the person that set this up to begin with, I would think.
That'd be a good person to see, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah.
That's just a factual intensive situation that you need to get to the facts and what the tax law is to get the right answer there.
Yep. Joe and Franklin, on to you now. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Just real quick, are the premiums for long-term health care insurance deductible?
Yes and no. On the Wisconsin return, they're definitely deductible. On the federal return, within limits, they're based on age, there's a different. As you get older, the more amount of long-term care premiums are treated as medical expenses. So what happens on the federal side, within the prescribed limits, you can add those to your other medical expenses, and if you get over the 7.5% threshold, you're entitled to deduct them. If you're self-employed, you might be able to include those with a self-employed health insurance deduction.
And in Wisconsin, is it a straight deduction?
It's a subtraction from federal income, yes. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at, if you get the Wisconsin instructions, there's a good part of a page or something like that that discusses the subtraction for long-term care premiums.
All right. Straight deduction from income, then.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Josh emailed to say my employer filed a Chapter 128 debt reorganization and shorted me on wages. Is that deductible for me? So if he was shorted $1,000, can he somehow deduct that, for example?
No, because you never paid tax on the income to start with, so there's no basis for taking any deduction.
Okay.
Right? I mean,
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Bob in Pleasant Prairie, on to you now.
Yes. I received a $250 check. I'm a senior citizen for being in the donut hole for prescription meds.
Okay.
And my question is whether that is taxable. I should report that income.
I have no idea because I've never had a look at it. I would assume it's. I really don't know. I have not had that question and. So I just don't know. So that was a $250 check. Never had the question. So I don't know.
Can't help you on that one, Bob. Sorry. Sue in Peshtigo. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. My parents' home is in our name.
What was that? I didn't understand.
Her parents' home is in her name.
The what?
Her parents' home is in her name.
Parents' name and home. Okay.
And they pay the payment and everything and the taxes, but it's still all in our name. They just replaced a bunch of windows in their house. So can they claim the tax credit for the windows, or do I have to?
Hmm. You know what, Steve? I'm going to let you ponder that.
Okay. We got a news break here.
Yeah, a little news break coming up. Steve's going to ponder that window deduction question. Larry Mueller here with Steve Schmidt, Managing Director of RSM McGladrey's office in Madison. Talking taxes, he'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll be back with him after a quick look at the news. Stay with us. So happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here as we talk your tax returns for 2010 with Steve Schmidt, CPA, Managing Director at the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. Join in at 1-800-642-1234 or via email at talk@wpr.org. And Steve, we had a caller, Sue from Peshtigo, who her parents have put the house, their house, in her name, but they're still making the payments on the house, paying the taxes and so forth, and then spent some money on upgrading their windows for energy efficiency. Since the house is in her name, would she be able to get a tax credit, or would the tax credit go to the parents?
I think neither, Larry. Basically, daughter owns the house. Parents are using the house in order to claim the energy, the credit for energy efficient improvements. The house has to be owned and used by the taxpayer as the taxpayer's principal residence. So it is the principal residence of her folks, but they don't own it.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter owns it, but it's not her principal residence. So I think there's no credit.
All right. There you go. Let's go to Brenda in Appleton. Brenda, hello to you.
Hi. I have a question regarding gifting. We had a second home. My son was living there. He decided he wanted to buy it, purchase it for his family. We went through the lending institution, and all we wanted, because he was paying taxes and the payments for the loan on the place, all we wanted was, you know, what the balance of the loan was. What we did was, in order so he did not have to pay any, put any money down or have that insurance on the house, you know, that extra, I can't think of what it's called.
Mortgage insurance?
Yes, the mortgage insurance. They actually had to increase his loan, and then my husband and I each gifted him the maximum so that he had, now he has, not collateral.
Isn't adequate down payment?
He had money, and he's got value in the property because of it.
Okay.
He's got equity.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yes, equity. So my question is, how do we, you know, put that in our taxes? Because we gifted it. What section, you know, in the taxes shows for gifting?
All right. So is your son married?
Yes, he is.
Did you gift it just to your son or to your son and your daughter-in-law?
Well, actually, at the time, they were not married, so it was just to him.
Okay. So, basically, each of you can gift up to $13,000 to your son, and you do not need to file a gift tax return. If the amount you gifted to him exceeded the $13,000, then
it was the maximum each.
So you each gifted him $13,000?
Yes.
But nothing more?
But nothing more.
Okay. Then you do not need to file a gift tax return. If you went over that, you'd need to file a gift tax return on Form 709. Now, let me ask you this. He bought the house?
From us.
at you know, if, he said you bought it for the existing mortgage.
Yes. We did have to increase it so that the gifting was in there.
But so let's use an example. Let's say the house was worth
$100,000. Yeah, okay. Let's go with something easy, something around.
So the house was worth $100,000, and the mortgage was how much?
Say it was $80,000. Well, subtract the gifting amount. I mean, we didn't make anything off of it.
But let's say the house is worth $100,000. And the mortgage was $80,000, and so there you've already given him $20,000, right?
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, if you gave him cash, whatever cash you gave to him, you'd have to add that.
So
add that up,
gifting,
and if the sum of those two is greater than $26,000, you need to file a gift tax return. You won't have any tax due, but you would need to file a gift tax return. In 2010, you can gift up to $1 million and not have to pay any tax. You just use up some of your exemption.
Okay.
So it's not a big deal. It's just you take a form to file.
Nope.
Okay. So in other words, then what I need to do is fill out the taxes. Because we have a sale of a house, technically, we have to put the selling price on there.
Oh, sure. That would be Schedule D. The selling price of the house compared to your tax basis would be gain.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a loss, you're selling to a related party, or it's a personal use asset, the loss wouldn't be deductible.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So gain's taxable, loss is not deductible.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Brenda, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn. Well, we got an email from Giuseppe from Milwaukee wondering, what's the deadline for an employer to send out my W-2, he wonders.
January 31st, it's supposed to be sent.
Yep, so it has to be in your hands by the...
Shortly thereafter, right?
Yep. Bob in Madison, on to you. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, and thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Easy question, I hope. I have a couple charitable gift annuities, and it's my wife and I. We've only been married 63 years.
Huh.
But they're all joined. It's always been joined. But I notice on the 1099s that I received, they have me listed as an individual. Does it really make any difference?
If you file a joint return, no.
We file jointly. We always have, yeah.
It won't make any difference.
No. Nope.
Just list the recipient and what they got on the 1099 and let it go at that.
That would be fine.
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks very much, sir.
Thanks for calling. Frank in Milwaukee. Hello to you.
Hello. I filed for a PEP this year and received it, and in the process have formed an LLC corporate or company with me as the sole proprietor, and have lawyer expenses that have gone along with that. Are those deductible on my personal income tax?
Sure. He filed for what, Larry? I didn't.
Pardon?
A patent.
Oh, a patent.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Patent.
All right. And are you in a business already?
I have not sold anything yet. I have not had people produce anything, but all of this happened before the end of last year.
Yeah. Patent expenses can be treated as research expenses, and there's a special rule. Normally, you can only deduct expenses that are involved in connection with carrying on an active trade or business. All right?
Mm-hmm.
But for research expenses, which patent expenses are qualified as, if it's in connection with a business. So if you intend to, if you're looking at getting into a business and it's in connection with that, you probably have a good basis for deducting those expenses. So if you plan on getting into a trade or business, I would claim those on Schedule C.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do intend to do that. All of this happened before the end of the year, so is it both federal and state?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Another question going back to those windows. Someone has owns a house and purchased another house and having it remodeled and had the remodeling work done but had not moved into the house yet, would they still be able to, the work apparently isn't done, but the windows were installed. Would a person the owner of the homes be able to deduct that as an expense?
Boy, the code says such component is installed in or on a dwelling unit located in the United States and owned and used by the taxpayer as a taxable principal residence. But they haven't used it yet, huh?
Right.
Boy, that might require some research because, I mean, technically, as I read the code section there, they haven't met that requirement. But if they're going to use it, you know, maybe get the Form 5695 instructions and read it and see if there's a reprieve under that situation. But reading the code itself.
Okay, so the 5596?
5695.
Oh, 5695. Okay.
Is the form. Let's see, home. I mean, just reading the 5695. Who can take the credits? Okay, home. A home is where you lived in 2010, and it can include a house, a houseboat, mobile home, blah, 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 blah. All right. I mean, that's what, just real quickly, but... it doesn't look real promising, but it might be worth some additional research, which I can't do right now.
All right. All right, let's go to Brian then in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian. Thank you for calling.
Hey, hello. My question is, my daughter graduated college, and I paid off her student loans. Now, is that a deduction that I can take, or is that her deduction since the loans were in her name?
There is a student loan interest deduction up to $2,500, and if you know you were obligated on the loan as a parent, I certainly would think you would be entitled to claim that deduction. Now there are income limits for a single taxpayer. The deduction gets phased out between $60,000 and $75,000 of adjusted gross income, and on a joint return, they get phased out between $120,000 and $150,000 of income. But take a look at the instructions on page 32 of the Form 1040, and see in your particular situation whether you or your daughter would be eligible. Who should claim it based on your facts?
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Betty in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Betty.
Hi. My question is that I inherited from my stepmother her estate. And part of the estate was HH bonds. And at that time, the government had me get them reissued in my name. That was in 2010. She died in 2009. Now, I just received the other day a tax form from the Bureau of Public Debt with her name and her Social Security on it reporting the interest for this year. So how do I handle that?
Boy, yeah. Well, obviously, if the reissuance is a taxable event, and you're the heir, you would have to pay tax on that interest.
Yeah, I expect to pay tax, but it's her name and her Social Security number.
Yeah, but if she was dead, her tax year ends at the death, so you would report it on your return.
Yeah, well, can I just use that same form, or do I have to get...
Yes, no, that's fine. You just report it on, if it's on your Schedule B. If your total interest is more than $1,500, you need to report it on Schedule B for interest and dividends. If you have less than that, you can report it right on line 8A as taxable interest. But the fact that it's in somebody else's Social Security number is not going to cause you a problem.
Okay. So I just submit that piece of paper then with my income tax.
You don't even need to submit it. All you need to do is report it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling. Kathy in Waukesha emailed just with a comment to say that please let people, low-income and elderly people, know they can get help with their returns through the VITA program.
Mm-hmm.
And information on that is available at that www.irs.gov. So IRS.gov, look for the VITA program if you're low income or elderly and would like additional help.
Great.
Donna in Mequonigo, let's go to you now. Hi, Donna.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a widow, and I also had received 10 months of disability pay through an insurance company from...
Oh.
Hello?
Oh, we lost her.
Well, maybe we can address the question in generalities. It sounds like she received disability income. And is that taxable or not is probably the question. Normally, the payor will give you the right form, and if they report it like on a W-2 as taxable, it's probably right. But just conceptually, if the person pays the premiums themselves and they're not deductible, then the receipt of disability insurance proceeds is not taxable. But if an employer pays the premium and the employee is not taxed on that premium, then the receipt of disability is taxable. So it depends upon who pays the premium.
Yep.
And so hopefully that helps Donna out, but I'm not sure what her question was, but likely it was something along those lines.
Let's try Bev in Delafield. Hi, Bev.
Hello. I have a two-part question. Hope it's not confusing to hear my wordage of it. Is it possible or is there a problem with an incremental gifting of real property using a series of quitclaim deeds over a couple of years and deeding a percentage of ownership that's equal or less than the annual maximum of $13,000?
No, that's the first part. Yeah, you certainly can do that.
Okay.
The only I can think of is, you know, if it's a certainty that you're going to do that, then the IRS could try to collapse it and say it all happened at once. In a little bit different context, where parents have loaned, let's say, $130,000 to their child and then started gifting $13,000 off the principal each year, mm-hmm. there are cases out there that hold that it was the intent of the parents to really just give them $130,000 up front, and the loan wasn't a legitimate loan, therefore it was a $130,000 gift all at once rather than $13,000 over 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, but as long as you continue to own and exercise dominion and control over the property, I think you probably have a right to to gift it in increments. It's just your facts need to be consistent that in fact you own the rest of the property, they own the balance, and you know you pay your expenses, they pay their expenses, mm-hmm. and you.
Well, if the long-term goal though is to turn it over to,
and that's fine. I mean, sure. I mean, you do it incrementally, mm-hmm. So you just need to make sure that you're really not. Give them the whole property right now. They're using the whole property right now.
No, it would be,
Yeah, so you just need to make sure your facts don't belie what you're doing.
Right. Okay, the second part of that is if and when they would turn around and sell it, is the tax basis the original purchase price or the value at the time the gifts were made?
It's your original cost, not the value. Unless the value is less than cost, then it would be the lesser of the two.
Yeah.
But if they sold it at a loss, if the value has gone up and you gift it, they get your carryover basis. So if it's a principal residence, where you could exclude the gain,
Okay, then it doesn't. Well, darn. Well,
all right, thanks.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
So, no, I mean, if you hold the property till death, if it's highly appreciated, then you get a day-to-death value, and you do get a step-up in basis. So, but that may not fit into your planning. But.
Yep. There you go. Well, Bob emailed and wonders, does it matter if I claimed a theft through insurance whether I can claim loss of income from tools? So it sounds like his tools were stolen. Collected money on the loss of the tools, but then wondering about collecting on the loss of income because he didn't have the tools for a time.
Well, from a tax perspective, if you don't include income in income, there's no deduction because there's no basis for it. I think we kind of had this question a little bit in a different context before. I wouldn't see where you get a deduction for not reporting income you didn't receive. Now, you might have a claim for, if your insurance policy covered loss of income, you certainly may wish to file an insurance claim if you were covered on that.
Mm-hmm. Gordon in Themesville, on to you now. Hi, Gordon.
Hello. I have two quick questions. The first one regards income tax refunds from the previous year. I applied some of the refund to my estimated tax and got some as cash in a check. Do I have to report the whole amount as if I got it?
Yes, assuming the refund is taxable, and
yes,
because you itemized the deductions and you benefited from it.
Yes.
But if you had alternative minimum tax in 2009, you probably didn't get a benefit.
Okay.
So watch that. So check your there's an alternative minimum tax line on page 2 of 1040 towards the top. If there was
right,
a dollar amount there that you had,
yeah,
then your refund likely isn't taxable.
Okay, the second question is on the 1040 line 44 where you figure your tax. I'm not clear whether I can use the tax table or some other worksheet because I'm filing Schedule D in order to report a capital loss, and I also have some amount of ordinary dividends.
Well, if you are eligible for the alternative capital gain rate of 15% on,
yes,
qualifying dividends, you'll need to go to the worksheet there or Schedule D to compute the lower tax on the qualifying dividend. So,
and by using that worksheet, you end up getting your total tax figure then?
Yeah. So let me give you an example. Let's say you had taxable income of $110,000. And $10,000 was from qualifying dividends. You'd compute the tax on $100,000 using the normal rate schedule, and you would be in a marginal rate bracket of 25%. So on some of that income, you'd pay a 25% marginal rate. Then you would simply multiply the $10,000 times 15% and pay $1,500 of tax on the dividends. So you'd add that $1,500 of tax on the qualifying dividends to the tax on your $100,000 of other taxable income to get your total tax, and that would be less than the tax if you just took $110,000 on the schedule. It would be less by 10% or $1,000.
Okay, but the $100,000 you get off the tax table?
Yes.
Tax for that?
Yeah.
Right, and if you go through those worksheets, it kind of, each line tells you exactly what to do and how you do the subtract,
okay,
and how you add those taxes together.
Okay.
So just walk through those steps carefully, and you should get the right result.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Are scholarships taxable?
Scholarships?
Yeah.
It depends. If you're undergrad and you use those for tuition and supplies, it's not. If you don't meet those requirements, then they are.
Oh, then they are. Well, Steve, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Larry. And hopefully Joe Nutini of our tax staff will be able to be on your program next time.
All right. Thank you again. It was great to hear your voice again. Thanks,
likewise,
Steve.
Larry.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye.
Steve Schmidt, CPA, MST, and Managing Director at the Madison Office of RSM McGladrey. He's done it for 25 years. And so he was stepping aside, and another fellow from his office was going to fill in, and he will be in the future. Steve has done it for 25 years. That's probably enough, but he was good enough to come back and be with us again today. So I really appreciate that, having him back. Just looking ahead, tomorrow we get a look at what's new in the world of bioenergy and bioenergy research and how it's affecting climate change. We'll also take a visit to skiing. Let's go skiing with Chad McGrath. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.